If you got your Bible, you can turn it on or open it to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And while you're finding that, I have a few questions I want to ask you. First off, I want to know how many people are new to Ecclesiastes. I'm not going to embarrass you or anything. For my own curiosity, who here, is this the first time, this sermon series is the first time you've ever kind of looked at Ecclesiastes? We got a few brave people, yeah? And now, that's good. So we got a few mostly experienced Ecclesiastes readers here. So this is for all of you, whether you're noobs or experienced. But for how many of you, is Ecclesiastes like a positive thing? How many of you are like encouraged? Like, yeah, I'm glad that I'm not the only one who wrestles with the existential questions of life. Yeah? Okay, I see a few hands. You know, you're not alone. This is an encouraging time. But then I guess for the rest of us, it's kind of like not so positive, right? Has it been kind of negative? Who's been struggling with Ecclesiastes? Nobody is struggling with Ecclesiastes. Oh, man. Wow, you guys are like either asleep or like you're like super saints. You are up there with Solomon himself. You've got it all figured out. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I read Ecclesiastes, I'm like, why is this stuff even in the Bible? You know, chapter 7, don't be too wicked, but don't be too righteous either. You know, why burn yourself out? What is it doing there? So whatever your relationship is to Ecclesiastes, I want you to know that this wrestling that we're doing, whether it's encouraging or a little bit negative, this is at the very heart about what it means to read the Bible, okay? And this is another little plug for how to read the Bible starting next week. If you open up to Psalm chapter 1, it says, you know, the ideal reader of the Bible is someone who meditates on the Bible night and day. And so Heather threw down a Hebrew word in her prayer, hevel. We'll get to that in a second. But I want to throw another Hebrew word your way. The word for meditate is haga. Now, haga can mean, obviously it gets translated meditate, but it can kind of mean mutter, like, you know, you're kind of reading out loud to yourself. It can mean moan or growl, haga, you know. And it kind of brings to mind, last summer we made these awesome rib steaks, and they were just delicious. And I actually made too many. I had one left over, and I had it sitting on the kitchen counter. And we wanted to enjoy the beautiful summer evening, so we were having dessert out on our back patio. And when we came back in, there was my dog. He had with the rib steak bone, and he was like on it. Haga, 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 haga. And he was making that sound. And there's this kind of like, I don't know, primal, visceral aspect to meditation where it's not just, you know, reading a couple of nice verses and having a happy thought for the day. There's with it kind of like this kind of element to it. Haga, haga, haga. And so when you're struggling with scripture, you're right in the sweet spot of what, you know, what the Bible is supposed to do in our lives. And so I just wanted to encourage you, you know, that thanks for sticking with us through Ecclesiastes this winter. Even if it messes with you, it messes you up a little in the head, you're in a good spot. So as we come to this grand finale of Ecclesiastes, I just want to recap some of the ground we've covered so far. Ecclesiastes falls into the category of writing known as wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is the fruit or the result of many wise people wrestling with the tough questions of life and trying to figure out the answer to how do I live the good life? What is the good life? How does one live well in the world? What is the meaning of life? This is what wisdom literature, the wise people of ancient Israel wrestled with. And there are three books in particular in the Bible that wrestle with this question. A couple summers ago, we did a series on Proverbs. And Proverbs, the main thesis of Proverbs is that wisdom is the key to living well. God used wisdom to create the world. And wisdom is woven into the fabric of the universe. And living well is simply living with the grain of wisdom in the universe. And in fact, it's integral to our spiritual life too, because in Proverbs 1:7 it says that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So living wisely is to live connected in relationship with God, the Creator. And this, if you just take this book by itself, you get a perspective of like intentional inputs with predictable outputs. Now, what does that mean? It means that if you live wisely, you will be blessed. And if you live foolishly, you'll be cursed. And that's Proverbs in a nutshell. Enter Ecclesiastes, or by his Hebrew name, Kohelet. That gets translated the teacher or the preacher. It could have been Solomon, whoever it was, decides that we're going to take that thesis of Proverbs and put it to the test and experiment. You know, like a good scientist. If a thesis is true, you should be able to repeat it and get the same results over and over again. And what the teacher discovers is that living by wisdom might be good, but there's a glitch in the system. Because what he discovered with all of his experimentation is that wisdom doesn't guarantee a good life here and now. In fact, and he uses the expression under the sun for like this life that we're living in right now, under the sun when it's shining above the clouds. There, in this life, in and of itself, there are very few guarantees. In fact, there's only three things that he kind of came to the conclusion of that you can take to the bank as certain. And warning, this is a little dark, but the three things that he came up with was death is inevitable. It's really the only sure thing that we can expect out of this life. The second thing is the march of time. It just keeps going and it obliterates any kind of legacy we would hope to live up to. Mount Yamnaska out there overlooking the Bow Valley has been there for thousands of years, and it will be there for thousands more. And it has watched as millions of people have traveled back and forth up and down the Bow Valley. And guess what? It remembers none of them. It will remember none of us. And kind of depressing. But don't wait, there's more. The third thing that he noticed is that chance afflicts us all. There is this randomness to life that contradicts this nice and tidy cause and effect paradigm that Proverbs lays out for us. And so he concludes that there's a glitch in the system. There are no guarantees in life, and he uses this metaphor that Heather Ann introduced us to in her prayer. Almost 40 times he uses the word hevel to describe our life. And literally that means smoke or vapor. We lose the metaphor when we translate it into English and we call it vanity, which to me is like a little table in your bathroom. Or meaningless, which life is full of meaning, but it's got this enigmatic, paradoxical quality that just when we think we've got it all figured out and we'll try to grab hold of it, it's gone. Hevel. That's what life is like. There's this glitch in the system, and he calls it hevel. And he starts his speech in chapter 1, verse 2, with this statement. Hevel, hevel, everything is utterly hevel. And then he ends his speech in chapter 12, verse 8, with that exact same statement. He repeats it. Hevel, hevel, everything is utterly hevel. So that's the second book. The third book of wisdom is the book of Job. And Job takes this whole conversation one step further by asking, what does this glitch in the system say about the character of God? Now that's a whole nother discussion for you to go home and haga, haga, haga on, okay? We're going to leave that alone. So, as we conclude our conversation around Ecclesiastes, we're going to linger on this question one more time. How do we live well in a world with few guarantees? What's the meaning of life? Why am I here? It's all driving everything in Ecclesiastes is driving at that one thing. Teacher concludes his experiment, and he's searching for meaning under the sun, and he discovers that life under the sun, so this life as we see it, in and of itself, apart from God, we cannot manufacture any kind of meaning in and of itself. He tried a lot of things. You know, you can build a career, and it might lead to success, but it also could cost stress, burnout, or relationships like our marriages, our family, our children. That success might lead to us accumulating a huge fortune. But in the end, you ultimately need to pass that fortune on to somebody else. And because of the chance nature of life, that somebody else might be a complete yo-yo who doesn't even appreciate what it took to build that fortune. We can live for pleasure. We can live for the pleasure of the weekend. But guess what? Monday always comes. We can plan our lives around exotic vacations. And we always have to come back, and we're usually jet-lagged. So the conclusion of the matter is that life under the sun, in and of itself, is hevel. It's this smoke-like enigma, impossible to grasp, and it begs the question, how does one live well when there's no guarantees? And at the end of the speech, hevel, hevel, all is hevel. So we're going to take one verse down from there and start at verse 9. And we're going to look at kind of the parting shot here. The speech is over and there's a change in person. So like the writer goes from writing in the first person and starts writing in the third person. And this is how it goes. I'm going to read it to you. We're just going to walk through this together here this morning. And I'm going to read from the message here. So besides being wise himself, the quester, that's Uncle Eugene's name for Kohelet or the teacher, the quester also taught others knowledge. He weighed, examined, and arranged many proverbs. The quester did his best. He arranged many proverbs. So just remember that. This isn't like Ecclesiastes trying to debunk proverbs. It's actually like, this actually goes together. They complement each other. They don't contradict each other. He was a contributor to the Proverbs. The quester did his best to find just the right words and write the plain truth. The words of the wise prod us to live well. They're like nails hammered home, holding everything together. They are given by God, the one shepherd. But regarding anything beyond this, dear friend, go easy. There's no end to the publishing of books, and constant study wears you out, so you'll be no good for anything else. Let's just stop there. So, in this closing argument or closing statement, we get a bit more free bits of advice, and I want us to look at two of them real quickly. So, bit of advice number one: live honestly, even when the truth hurts. The words of the words of the wise prod us to live well. I stole this picture from the Bible Project. They do these awesome posters of all the books of the Bible. And you got a picture here of the shepherd, and the teacher's words are that pointy part of the shepherd's stick. It's a goad that like they use to like get the sheep going in the direction that they should go. And I'm thinking, what's something like, there's no shepherds, we're ranching country here. We deal with cattle. We don't deal with little sheep most of the time. And I was trying to think, like, what's something in our kind of more immediate experience that can relate to this image of a goad? And so it got me thinking about talking to one of my neighbors. Sarah Wilson is kind of a resident horse person that I know. She lives on my street. And she lent me these spurs, which is like another kind of tool that we use to kind of do the same thing that the goad is used for with sheep. And you have different kinds of spurs used for, basically, different kinds of saddles that you use correspond to the kind of spur that you'll use. And Sarah shared with me some interesting things. I don't know anything about horses other than that they're big, bigger than me, and scary. But she said, I got her to explain to me, like, what do you use these things for? They kind of look ugly and scary. You strap them onto the heels of your boot, and you wear them while you're riding. And so she shared a bunch of things with me, some of which made sense that I remember. Other stuff is like, you know. But this was what I got out of it. These are used as a tool to communicate with your horse. And you use it when you're training a brand new horse, but you also want to use it. You can use them when you've got a very experienced horse. And something else she said is that the spur is never the first means of communication. Good riders will use their legs, their shift in their weight, the reins, and their voice as kind of the more, those are ways that get priority over using the spur. Remember these things a little later on when we talk about the shepherd a little bit further. It's also possible, she said, that to overuse these things and then the horse becomes desensitized to them altogether. I thought all that stuff was really interesting. You guys can ruminate on that while we're talking about these wise words that hurt a little bit. But looking throughout this book, Ecclesiastes is basically saying, look, the facts don't lie. There's a glitch in the system, and we can't control the outcome. Yet, it's still worth living a life of wisdom, even if it doesn't guarantee a good time in the here and now. A little bit of pain can prevent a big pain later. A foolish life now will ultimately bring God's judgment later. So that's why something like a goad or a spur can be a good thing. In Psalm 23, we get a picture of the Lord as our shepherd. And in that psalm, the poet writes, "Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your goad and your staff, they comfort me." How can a pointy stick be comforting? A little pain now can prevent a lot of pain later. You know, maybe getting a slap on the hand from my mom when I'm young might save me from the pain of burning myself on the stove or on a fire. Maybe a little self-denial will open up possibilities later, like not spending everything I want on myself whenever I want, so that I can be able to save up for something more important later on. Maybe a broken heart when I'm young will teach me a thing or two about relationships, so that later on I might be ready to recognize the love of my life, not just another yo-yo trying to date me. Your rod, your goad, your staff, they comfort me. Wisdom says a little pain now could prevent big pain later. Bit of advice number two. Make up your mind honestly. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to the words of the wise, of making of books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. I don't know if you know this, but the internet has a lot of information. I looked it up this week. There are, if you were to take the totality of information on the internet, it would, estimates are it's about 1 million exabytes. That's 10 to the 24th power of bytes of information. So that's like a 1 with 25 zeros after it. I tried playing it in my audio, I typed the number out in my manuscript, and I made Google like read it back to me, and it was hilarious because like for like a minute it was 0000, 0000. It's a lot of bytes. That's what I'm trying to say. And if you were to take all that bytes and burn them onto CD-ROM disks, you would end up with a stack of disks that would go from here all the way to the moon. And then you could start another stack on the moon and get a quarter of the way back to Earth. That's how much information is out there. And another way that you can measure the size of the internet is by its traffic. And Cisco, that company that makes routers and stuff, they estimate that by next year, 2019, global traffic is expected to hit 2 zettabytes per year. A zettabyte is one step higher than an exabyte. That's the equivalent of 72,000 years of high-definition video. So that's like playing the entire Netflix catalog over 6,000 times. So we have a lot of information at our disposal. And with all this information, I don't know about you, but I get tempted to just kind of like get into analytical mode when I'm trying to figure out decisions in life. You know, when considering a college or a university, it can take forever to commit to one school or declare a single major. When we're in dating relationships, we can hedge on commitment because I just don't know if I know this person well enough yet to really commit. When we're purchasing a home, we can research forever and ever and analyze the market and end up feeling like it's never going to be the right time to buy. We can do that with every decision in life. We have a way of overthinking things, and I think there's this kind of deceitful part of our heart that tries to use overthinking as kind of a sophisticated way of procrastinating an important decision. We end up putting off God in the name of intellectual honesty. And C.S. Lewis portrays this intellectual honesty brilliantly in a book he wrote called The Great Divorce. It's a novel that describes a man who is living in the suburbs of hell. And he gets on a bus and he goes to the outskirts of heaven, where by God's just amazing grace is invited to come into heaven and basically change addresses. And in this invitation, a spirit warns this man. He says, no sphere of your usefulness. The spirit in the invitation says, I can't promise you everything that you're expecting when you come to heaven. I can promise no sphere of your usefulness. You're not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land, not of questions, but of answers, and you shall see the face of God. But the man's not ready to buy into this. He's not ready to let go of his quest for truth. He wants to study some more. And so he says, well, we must all interpret those beautiful words in our own way. For me, there's no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? Listen, God's Spirit says to the man. Once you were a child, and so once you knew what inquiry was for, there was a time when you asked questions because you wanted answers. And you were glad when you found them. Become that child again, even now. But the man refuses, sadly. He says, oh, well, I'm a man. I put childish things aside. And the conversation kind of abruptly ends there when he remembers that he's late for a discussion group in hell. So off he goes. You can wear yourself out contemplating the existential questions of life. The teacher tells us, don't wear yourself out on this. There will be no end to the amount of books and websites and documentary videos that are going to be published. So for Pete's sake, make up your mind honestly. So those are the main streams of advice. Live honestly, but don't obsess about the big questions of life forever. Ecclesiastes says that this hevel life holds no guarantees. But he does kind of hold out a few little things that you might have noticed throughout the course of this series. You can enjoy life's simple pleasures. You can live with an open hand and stop trying to be so obsessive and controlling about your life. So, it still seems like everything's kind of contingent on me from that perspective. I've just got to accept this hevel life, learn my best to cope and be happy. Boo! I'm booing Ecclesiastes. But wait, I didn't get to the good part. I didn't get to the grand finale that the teacher gives us. So, starting again in verse 13, here's the grand finale. The last and final word is this. Fear God, do what he tells you. And that's it. Eventually, God will bring everything that we do out into the open and judge it according to its hidden intent, whether it's good or evil. This Hevel life is redeemed by fearful, obedient relationship with God through Jesus. In the end, the only way to live in the Hevel is to have a perspective that goes beyond the sun, beyond the Hevel. There's more to life under the sun. There's more to life than what we can see. The meaning of life is found when you get out from under the sun and find that meaning when you live in relationship, fearful obedience of God. The NIV puts this verse in sharp focus here when it says, the full duty of all mankind is to fear and obey. That's our duty. If we're going to embrace our God-given duty, we need to put God at the center of our perspective. If we want to embrace the meaning of life, we need to put God at the center of our perspective. So, the real question is what's stopping us from embracing that duty? Let me close with two questions. First question, who do you fear really? Like, whose opinion really matters to you? Is it peers? Like, we all know the stereotype of hockey moms and hockey dads living vicariously through their kids because, you know, they weren't good enough to succeed at hockey. And we laugh and joke about that, but I know I do this all the time. Not with hockey. We all suck at hockey at our house. But I fear other parents. On a deep level, I can get sucked into this idea that when others observe the choices that my kids make, that's somehow a reflection on me. That is messed up, man. What about our parents? Do we fear our parents? Do we fear disappointing them? What about our spouse? Do we live in fear of losing them? One preacher that preached on this passage asked an interesting question. He's like, who will you sin for? If you want to know who you fear, just ask yourself, how far am I willing to go to keep the approval or keep that person around? That might be your clue. Now, when it comes to the question of what does it mean to fear God? We often start with trying to define what that fear looks like, and we end up with something like reverence or awe and in relationship, and that's okay. But I want us to focus on a different part of this, because I don't want to water this down. What if Kohelet, the teacher, is asking, who do we fear more than God? Because when you fear that person, you're putting that person above God. And the Bible has a word for that. It's called idolatry. There's more to life under the sun than what we can see. But when we get caught up with what other people think about us, we're living in fear of someone or something other than God. The meaning of life is to fear God alone as the one who we ultimately care who thinks of us. Second question, why do you obey, really? What motivates you to play by God's rules? I had to take developmental psychology courses throughout my theological training, and one thing I learned there is that there are different stages of moral development, and the youngest, most immature, most primitive instincts that we have in terms of like the moral choices we make are punishment avoidance. and trying to get a reward. Is that why we played by God's rules? I remember when our kids were younger, well, first off, I have to tell you, I didn't always avoid the punishment. I am a very strong-willed person. And I remember once I'd kind of made a big mess of my toys, and my mom was trying to assert her will and said, listen, you're going to put those blocks away or you're going to get a spanking. And next thing she realizes, I'm in the bathroom bent over the toilet saying, I'm ready for my spanking. So I don't know what was motivating that moral choice of mine, but it wasn't fear of punishment. I guess I didn't fear my mom enough. But when it came time for me to be on the other side of that equation with my little kids, they were strong-willed and stubborn like I am. And I said, listen, you're going to do this one way or the other. So we can do this the easy way or the hard way. What do you want to do? But they didn't really want to obey. Why are we obeying? Is it just to avoid punishment? Or is there something deeper to it? Is there something deeper to that relationship with God that motivates us? You know, even deeper than just for like the common good, you know, that it's going to go well for everybody if I play by the rules. Maybe we do it to avoid punishment. Maybe we do it to make ourselves look good. You know, there is a certain status to be gained by being, you know, righteous in certain cultures. And is that why we do it? Whatever we're doing, whether it's a punishment avoidance or looking to gain something out of it, we're trying to control the narrative. And Ecclesiastes teaches us that trying to control our life is foolish. There's more to life under the sun than what you can see. There's more to life than getting away with something or being good to get away from something. So what's the proper motivation for obedience? What commands are we expected to obey? Well, the teacher gives us a clue here. He says that this wisdom is given by one shepherd. And that word shepherd is like a... I think it's like a hyperlink that should make us think about shepherds in the Bible. Just like it made me think of like the Lord is my shepherd in Psalm 23. But it makes me think also of another shepherd. In John 10, Jesus is speaking and he says, I am the good shepherd. The gatekeeper opens the gate for the shepherd, and the sheep listen to his voice and he calls his own sheep by name and he leads them out. He didn't need to use a goad. He heard their voice. They heard his voice. Sorry. You know, I'm the good shepherd. The shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. My sheep, I know my sheep. And my sheep know me just as the Father knows me and I know the Father. I think one advantage we have as Christians looking back on Ecclesiastes is we have the benefit of looking at things through the lens of Jesus, through the lens of the cross. And it gives us a whole different perspective on this glitch, the hevel glitch of life. Jesus gives us the great commandment. In Mark, he replies, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and all the prophets, they hang on these simple two commandments. And if you read the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 through 7, you get this idea again. He reiterates this idea that the whole matter of what God expects from people is to love. Love God, love your neighbor, love your enemy. This God, the one that gives us meaning and purpose, he's a good shepherd. And all he commands us to do is reciprocate love. Now, Paul is a guy who got this. And he, you might remember this. In fact, for those of you who are married, you might have had these words spoken at your wedding. He penned one of the most eloquent descriptions of love. And at the end of these of this beautiful poem, he connects love to how we live in the hevel of life. Because he says, starting in verse 9 in 1 Corinthians 13, he says, "For we know in part and we prophesy in part." We don't get the whole picture now. "But when the completeness comes, what's in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. And when I became a man, I put away the childish things behind me. Now we only see a reflection as in a mirror." Mirrors back then weren't very good. It's like fog. It's like hevel. "Now we only see a reflection in the hevel. Then we shall see him face to face. Now I know in part, then I'll know fully, even as I am fully known." So, in the here and now, there are three things that remain: faith, love, and hope. And the greatest of these is love. We might be caught in the inescapable hevel of life here under the sun, but when we obey Christ's command to love, we can never go wrong. You can take that to the bank. So, in closing, you might have heard news that you might have heard the news that this past week Billy Graham passed away. And for those of you who are maybe too young to really kind of appreciate the full impact of his ministry, in the history of Christianity, no person has done more to spread the gospel to more people and invite more people into the fear of the Lord than Billy Graham. He was a model for passionate, evangelistic, missional living. He was a model of humility and transparency. And during the 80s, when other televangelists were doing untold damage to the image of the faith, he was kind of like a beacon of integrity. He never pretended to be perfect, and he just simply did his best to obey his maker and live into his calling. And so I've been thinking about all the different things. Now that he's passed away, there's like a whole deluge of things being written and talked about his life. And a lot of it's positive and respectful, and some of it not so much. And I think that reality resonates a lot with what we've been learning in Ecclesiastes. Graham's life may not be remembered exactly for how he expected his legacy to look. His legacy may not be remembered exactly how we would want it remembered and talked about. But all that, his legacy, his reputation, it's all hevel. Graham didn't live for approval of people here under the sun. He just lived in the fear of the Lord, and he did his best to be obedient. So, I know we got a little over time here, but just humor me. I'm just going to get you to listen to this short song. It was a song written about 30 years ago, in the height of all the televangelistic scandal and stuff. An artist that I was really interested in did a short little song just as a tribute to him, and I think it's appropriate that we listen to it now. There won't be any words. Do we have the song ready? All right. So yeah, just listen to these words and think about this hevel life we live, and how this one man is a good example of how to live life under the sun.
"I don't know about those other guys. There's something in the back of their eyes. But Billy, you're the man, who don't you slide a hand, ain't wearing no disguise. I love you, Billy. I love the simple things you say, and you never never seem to get in the way. No one is quite like you, compassionate and true. Just as I am, I say,
let's pray. Loving Father, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit, we thank you for the gift of life. We thank you that we can live it in partnership with you. And we also acknowledge that this life is not easy. And it's full of mystery and frustration, and yet here we are. My prayer is that for those of us that are really fighting with the devil right now, and they're going through some dark stuff like the valley of the shadow of death, I pray that you would meet us in that, and that you would help us to fear you and love you and obey you well. And for those of us who or maybe living on the sunny side of the hevel right now, I pray that you would use us to come alongside, be an encouragement, be compassionate and true. And we just, again, all we can do is say thank you for this life, as topsy-turvy as it can be. Help us to live it well, Lord. Amen.